I can tell you, I can reveal that Steve Field is here.
Main event, I'm afraid.
Welcome,
Fresh from the Prime Minister's briefing today.
No, Todd, I'm really sorry, but it's taken us an hour, actually, to get half a mile. We got out of the taxi in the end, and by the end, we got back in the taxi because it caught us up.
I think there's been an emergency security alert in the centre of London.
We talked about that, but actually... We heard there was a problem on that as well.
Steve, come and clutch your breath.
You're quite right.
Just before you get into the meat, could you ask and sort out the process question, which I'm going to have to leave at some point.
Right.
Many of us have put what I hope are reasoned and well-thought-through arguments to the Bill Committee for the legislation that is currently in the House. I have looked on the Futures Forum website how to interact
Steve will certainly pick that up in his...
Can I just... Yeah. So sorry that Steve has agreed to stay for a bit longer. He's cancelled an event following this one. So those people who can stay... We've also ordered some sandwiches.
Stand up,
you're
right.
Before we start, so process what? Sandwiches will arrive at the back, will they?
Oh, it's food.
And then, we'll try and do it in a seemly way while continuing the momentum of the event.
Did you have a competition contract for the sandwiches?
Yeah,
we did actually. Yeah,
we have to protect essential sandwich services. Actually, that's the thing.
Steve, people have been very patient. We've been experimenting with some voting technology, experimenting being the operative word, and having a wide ranging discussion about issues of accountability, which people feel very strongly about,
yeah.
And clearly also competition. And we've just latterly been talking about the commissioning role of GPs and others and how it all will knit together. So perhaps you could give us just, the very, very short version of of what you're about, and picking up the colleague's point there about how people who've already given evidence can rely on that, surviving or not.
Thank you. Can I just start? I'm really sorry. This has been a really exciting morning for some reasons and a bloody awful morning for other reasons. Yes, we had problems on the tube, but also the Westway was closed. So we've actually been round the back of Wormwood Scrubs, and which was quite interesting, and the Hammersmith. And anyway, that's my problem, not yours. The meeting after this, we've got somebody else to go and do, so I don't have any time constraint right the way up until about 4 o'clock. So you can ask as much as you like. I'm a GP. Sorry. All right, I'm a GP in Birmingham, as many of you will know. I continue to see patients in Birmingham. And I stood down from leading the Royal College of GPs in November of last year. My day job before that was head of workforce and the regional postgraduate dean in the West Midlands. There's a lot of echo on this. I don't know if you can see, but and I've worked in the NHS since I started as a medical student in 1977. So, my personal beliefs are we need an NHS which is truly national. That adapts and grows so that the ageing population that we have to look after has an NHS fit for purpose then. And where I'm coming from, because we all do have baggage, is that I do believe in an integrated healthcare system which is integrated around the needs of the patient, more with health and social care being much more seamless than it is now, whilst allowing choice for patients as well. So that's where I'm coming from. I'm very open about that. I was asked to chair this Future Forum about 4 or 5 weeks ago now, and then we put together a team of 44 people who were mixtures of managers and doctors and nurses, AHPs, Sally Brearley bringing in a very strong patient voice there. Yeah, Sally Brearley and as their Well, it isn't about the volume of people who are there, but it's about how we listen to people outside the forum as well as inside. So what we've done is, Prime Minister has guaranteed, as you know, my independence. I think you can hear what I'm trying to say in the Guardian article on Saturday, which was a fair representation of where we are at the moment. What we're trying to do is recheck with the public, with professionals, with patients, what their feelings are about the NHS at the moment, and write an independent report in the first week of June. So I'm not here on behalf of the government. I'm fiercely independent. Those of you who know me will know that. I haven't accepted a Department of Health email address or any of the sort of niceties of having an office in Richmond House for myself. I want to be out there and working. We do have a team of civil servants which we chose to support the exercise. So when we go out on a visit, we take somebody with us to take notes. We often audio tape what's happening. And in addition to all of that, we've also got the 6,000 or so responses for the white paper, and we've also got 600 or so responses for the workforce paper and the public health stuff as well. So we're not going in blind. Some of the early themes we did talk about in The Guardian would be the conundrums of how do you allow patients to have choice whilst protecting NHS services that need to be protected is the main issue that's coming out. So we know the evidence, the academic evidence is that people have exercised choice through choose and book, particularly on the edges of big conurbations over the last few years. We know that there's a lot of strong feelings about protecting people's local hospital, whether that's in Hereford as a small area or in central Birmingham. We know that some of the outcomes are not as good as they could be. We know that there's variation in the quality of primary care across the country, particularly access for the groups I'm particularly interested in. I lead another group looking at the care of the homeless, travellers and sex workers and asylum seekers. So I'm passionate about inequality. So the choice and competition is the main issue that keeps coming up. There is something about education and training in the workforce, which, to be perfectly honest with you, is a longer term issue. What we have to do is really say very strongly to the government, there is no rush on this. You need to sort out where deaneries go about providing training at the moment, but why the rush to sort something out in a few months? So we'll say something about the pace of change. The other issues on commissioning that are coming up very strongly is there needs to be much more clinical engagement, nursing, AHPs, specialist doctors in the commissioning process. But the overarching thing is the patients, the public, this is their, our NHS, and whatever happens with the new reforms, there needs to be much more patient involvement in the commissioning process, design of pathways, and in the governance processes. The key to that will be Health Watch and the Health and Wellbeing Board. I'll pause there because I could talk, as many people will know, for an hour and a half, 2 hours anyway, but I'd rather hear what your concerns are. Bear in mind, I'm not coming from the government, so shouting at me is fine, I can take that, but I'd rather have, you know, an idea of solutions as well as problems.
Steve, let me just tell you that we've got a fairly sceptical audience here, as you may guess. And that was reflected in the sort of votes we had before you arrived. We asked people, would competition help the NHS to improve? 61% said no. Will the NHS become more accountable to patients through the reforms? 75% said no.
Yep.
And surprisingly, are family doctors best placed to commission services for patients? 74% said no. So that's the kind of... The mood of the meeting.
Yeah, not helped by me being late, I know.
And it's probably uglier. Yeah. let's see. Can we come back to the psychologist? Because you made a very interesting point earlier. So could you just perhaps kick us off?
Is there a
microphone?
Yeah. It's good. Okay. I recognise myself occasionally.
Internally or externally?
Okay. Well,
Just reintroduce yourself to Steve.
Yeah, I'm a consultant psychologist and psychotherapist working in the NHS. A couple of things, and one of the things I think that really concerns people out in the NHS, that I'm sure you've heard, is the principle of any willing provider. Mm. And in my own area, which is psychological therapies, we've had really very poor experiences of private companies coming in and running primary care psychological therapies services. It's tended to break up the care pathway. We've found that these companies have just creamed off the easy cases, and anything with any level of complexity has just been passed on to the NHS. Mm. So that's a real concern. And the other issue, more general issue, is that it begs the question how skilled and how knowledgeable GPs are in commissioning mental health services. And, and certainly, one concrete suggestion would be to include professions such as psychologists, psychotherapists, psychiatrists in commissioning mental health services.
Yeah. Okay. Can I take those?
Thank you.
Can I take the second one first, and then remind me about the first one, about it's about quality and anyone provide. In the bill, so I'm not an apologist for what's written in the bill. I'm listening to your solution. So that's, I agree with what your sentiment is in the second part. But also I'd say that's exactly the same for maternity, for children's care, and for actually a lot of physical health, probably all of physical health. So I think the original idea, from what I can glean, is that it was down as GP-led commissioning because under the last government, world-class commissioning was meant to be clinically led. And I don't know if you know, but there was a whole assessment regime around that. And we know that there wasn't enough clinical engagement and leadership in many PCTs. And GPs have felt for many years not engaged because they were put to one side with the professional executive committee. So I think the initial aim was to get GPs more engaged. Now, having been around lots and lots of pathfinders and spoken to those who aren't yet pathfinders, I haven't found one yet which hasn't intended to commission with other specialists and nursing and patient input. I haven't on the ground found one. But the impression is that this is GP only. And I think some of the GPs sometimes can be quite bullish about making change, which actually the unintended consequences on the public is not helpful. So my belief, for what it's worth, and you know, chairing this independent review, is it needs to be clinically led commissioning supported by high quality managers. That many things, well, I'll answer PCTs later if you want, but PCTs are different now. They've lost their provider arm to what they were, and public health is moving. So what you need, sorry? No, the provider arm was moved before the election. Changes were before the election. So if I could answer the question, I'm quite happy to, you know, I said spend all day, but so from a commission, and I'm not the government, I'm trying to listen, and if I, you know. So from a clinically led commissioning point of view, some things will be needed to be done at local, very, very local level. That might be prescribing issues or individual decisions about health and social care in a much more integrated way. When you start to commission mental health services, you need to have much more user input into commissioning mental health, as well as not just psychiatrists. So in my last workforce role, I furiously tried to get psychologists and psychiatrists in the same room, and as you'll recognise, it has been difficult over the years. So part of the integration is to get psychologists, psychiatrists, counsellors, patients, GPs all working together. But as you know, Turning Point provide, I've lost my thread now, but the mental health services substance misuse delivery is done by third sector to very high quality in some areas. So going back to your first point, you need to make sure that whatever happens, quality is improved, not just maintained. And you should be able to, as a patient, receive the same quality services wherever you live to people in central Birmingham or Manchester. That has to be the... And we'll say a lot about clinical commissioning. We'll say a lot about quality. We'll say things about competition, not on price, which the government have already ceded anyway.
Steve, in your interview with The Guardian on Saturday, you hinted that in some areas, for some specialisms, it would need to be consortia of consortia that do the control.
Yeah. I mean, whatever happens now or in the future, some commissioning decisions are made between the patient and the doctor. Some are made at a practice level. Some are actually made by the primary care mental health teams, actually, and where they go. So some issues will be, well, you know, why on earth don't we have open access physiotherapy when the evidence shows that it saves money, keeps people in work, when some areas that's blocked either by the GPs or by the PCTs, as they are now, mostly PCTs, through to if you're going to have maternity services, they will cross a lot of boundaries of consortia. So networks to provide the commissioning will be the way forward. And for paediatric neonatal cardiology and services like that, they'll probably be commissioned nationally. And somewhere you have to make the right cut. But in all of those instances, patients and the public need to be engaged right from the start, not just when there's a consultation on reconfiguring services.
Can we take comments specifically on this issue? Nothing that will take us anywhere else at the moment. Yes?
I'm Deborah Grell, independent health strategy consultant, maternity expert. I actually don't think the case has actually been made that this is a viable option.
For maternity or generally?
No, generally. I think last autumn I attended an event chaired by Ruth Carnell, NHS London's chief exec, who made it very clear that the 28 PCTs across London would have to go down to 5 sectors, purely for financial reasons, that it was no longer viable. Mm. When I looked on the NHS website last, there were 37 consortiums in London alone. So either it's going to be a much more costly exercise, or they will have to actually amalgamate, which actually means the loudest voices will get their way, because the smallest consortium was 43,000, the largest was 377,000, and the localism it will just be a myth.
Steve?
Well, there's a, you know, as people work through wherever their locality is, the idea is to actually allow more local decision making on where and the configuration of those consortia. So I can give you also some examples of how it would be very difficult at the moment for the same reasons. I could also give you some reasons why things are going well in other areas. So most people in this country live outside London. London does have peculiar problems, as we know, with so many hospitals and so much money invested in quaternary and tertiary care. And patchy primary care services, I would say, in some areas. So, and some brilliant primary care services. If you go to Herefordshire, where I was 2 weeks ago, they have a joint health and social care, what was the Care Trust. Well, one of the things we mustn't do is give anything up that's working well. So the Care Trust is working well. The problem there is they've got a small hospital, which is difficult to maintain from a cost point of view, whereas if you're in a big city, it's very different. So what we've got to try and do, I think, is help the government think it through so that you can have good local services with much more patient involvement. And as they move through this transition phase, which for me is the most critical issue, transitioning from here to wherever he is, we don't drop the baton and maintaining services, you quite rightly say, need to happen. But it's very difficult, isn't it?
The same point, please. Yes?
Thank you. I'm Frances Reid and I work for Target Ovarian Cancer. We've worked with you in the past.
I remember, yes. Yeah.
On supporting GPs diagnosing ovarian cancer.
Yeah,
it's a very tricky area.
Yeah.
Our points in relation to these are, yes, GPs are generalists, and we would strongly welcome specialist support in the commissioning process, definitely. We believe GPs are conflicted, though, as providers as well as purse holders. The government recently announced access to diagnostic for GPs. There have also been news reports of third-level tiers coming in and reviewing GP referrals now and cutting them back. It's been accepted nationally that women who have symptoms of ovarian cancer need to be assessed more often. Apparently, we lose nearly 500 women a year. We only match the European average. We want to put forward and ask about the role of NICE quality standards and the role of outcome measures. And if these aren't mandatory, and if they're not, then if local consortia are not accountable as to why they're not following these quality standards, we envisage postcode lotteries, and we envisage through the outcome measures some diversification in some ways.
It's a specific issue, but obviously with much broader applications.
I mean, and we've done a lot of, well, as a college, we did a lot of work. Ovarian cancer is a peculiar illness, isn't it? It really is terrifying. And we do need to make sure we get quicker diagnosis and quicker access to diagnostics. Part of the problem in the past is whenever we've referred for ultrasound scans for abdominal problems in men and women, but women particularly, you get this feeling that if you're referring a lot, it takes a while, and if you get it wrong because the woman's okay, that's a failure. And the way the language between specialists and GPs has been quite difficult. So what we've got to try and do is produce a much more integrated system where you know, the patient can get very quick, rapid diagnosis, and it doesn't really matter who does that as long as it's quick. And I think your guidelines are brilliant, actually, the stuff. On NICE standards, yes, I agree with you. There need to be national standards where you can make national standards. The problem in medicine is a lot of things you can't actually give a standard for because things are moving and changing. You know, otherwise, you know, why haven't we had standards for ovarian cancer for a while? We've now got Willie Hamilton doing all this early diagnostic work. The standard in 5 years' time will be probably our decision-making will be supported by decision-making software as well as everything else. So I agree with you. I'm not fully convinced that how NICE sets its standards is open enough. And there's a question with NICE, of course, over the economic issue of their decisions and whether that's right. And we've heard some issues about that. But if the sentiment is you need national standards implemented locally and those who are commissioning need to adhere to those standards, then I agree.
Hand at the back, gentleman there.
Yeah, on the GP commissioning issue, 2 points.
Briefly.
Yeah, very briefly. Do you think there's enough consistency across GP consortia, whatever their size, in terms of the quality of service which individual GPs are able to provide? And that there'll be inequalities within consortia about some people and GPs having a very positive experience and using a positive experience. Others, where there are basically failing GPs within there, how will the consortia arrangements address those issues?
Well, what do you think on that, just to
I think it's a really difficult thing when the public need to know a lot more about the quality standards of GPs. I don't just mean league tables and things like that.
Okay.
I'm talking about clinical advances some GPs buy into, others don't. And we as the public never know that.
You know, can I keep on that point for a second? Because it's really important, that, because I think, for me, one of the real wins of whatever system we move to has to be about improving the quality of primary care.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you're in Tower Hamlets, I don't know how many of you are from Tower Hamlets, and Tower Hamlets had a very strong, brilliant chief exec and medical director, and they had the record for referring GPs to the General Medical Council and but they also had probably the best PCT for supporting all doctors to improve. And part of that was the sharing the information between each GP so they can see where they are from a variation point of view. And a paper I helped write, which I would commend to you, was the King's Fund review of general practice, which highlighted some of those variations. So I think you're absolutely right in what you're saying. To test it out as patients, do you think you should have access to more information about outcomes from general practice? And if so, how would you do that? Because I believe we should share as much information as we possibly can. And then you can make judgments. And GPs are all competitive. We'd all want to improve what we're doing. But the second bit to that is, if you're commissioning, say, diabetes care, as it is at the moment, you probably don't know whether you're going to a good or bad GP. You probably do, because you probably look it up, but most people don't. And I know from GPs that have been struck off or suspended near where I work that actually their diabetes care has been appalling. So my vision, and I'll just to test it out, would be that we need a much more integrated system so that you're looking across the population of your diabetics. And you could do that in a consortium so that specialist GPs and patients working together would look to make sure the control is good and what the quality is. But also, if a patient's having difficulty and they aren't meeting the quality outcome at that particular level in the pathway, they automatically see a specialist, so the specialist can automatically intervene. And that would be what happens in some of the best integrated care organisations in the US, which are not-for-profit. It's all about incentivising along, but the patient is in control. I mean, does that sound sensible to you as an option?
I think there's some really big issues about health inequalities and how people access the system.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm thinking of authority, just any ROs, PCTs, and we all know if you work within the system, there are good practices and bad practices.
Yeah.
And I'm highlighting an issue about actually extenuating health inequalities, both within a given consortium and across consortium.
I agree.
Clinical pathways which people might well, the public, sign up to, but their GPs are not offering or cannot offer because of facilities and size, and we're not even allowed to use the word polysystem anymore.
Yeah. No, I agree with everything you've said. So what, and part of that is there needs to be robust governance arrangements in and quality standards for primary care as well as secondary. I agree absolutely. What I would add, though, is that they need to be along the whole pathway. And within that, patients will want to have some choice. Even in parts of London, I do a lot of work with the homeless. Many of them say they can't access general practice services because they're turned away by their GP. That's a disgrace. We must stop that.
We have a point of agreement. We have a point of agreement. Let's cut while the going's good. We're also, Steve, taking comments from our users online, and Laura is monitoring what they're saying. Laura, have we got a mic?
Sure. Okay, so yes, the voice of our readers, not I should say. So a couple of quick points. First from Jonathan Tomlinson, who is a GP in Hackney and part of the Barry NHS Public Steering Committee. He asks a bit on that point, actually, which was how are we going to avoid GP commissioning cherry-picking patients for particular services? We've also got a question from Blackburn Hack, who is a freelance journalist, who asks, excuse me, I'll put it up. If the NHS reforms are about giving power to GPs, why are they being told, that's GPs, who and what services they will have to buy from clusters? And finally, this is also on GP commissioning consortium. He's responding to the gentleman behind me's question and point. Daniel Sparrow says, I agree with the point made in terms of specialist knowledge held by GPs. As a counsellor, I was lucky enough to work in a GP setting that had a doctor who had psychotherapy training and a qualification. The level of service delivered to patients referred to this service was the better for this. However, I wonder how many such people exist in our frontline services up and down the country. By choice and training, GPs are just that, general practitioners, because it makes sense to ask them to build niche knowledge.
Take cherry-picking, yes, we shouldn't cherry-pick. And the problem is that people are saying, well, the reforms, whatever they will be, are going to allow more cherry-picking and doctors won't take the patients. Frankly, we're not that good in some parts of the country now. So I think what happens is people are worried about what's happening now and then fast forward and say it'll get worse. So GPs should provide care for all of those patients who want to sign on with them. You know, there are some limits because limits to the building size and things like that, but patients shouldn't be turned away because of not having a utility bill, which I've heard in the last few weeks. I was just along the road at UCL where they've got the most amazing care for the homeless. But, you know, whether you're homeless or traveller, whether you're old or young, you should all be able to access NHS care free at the point of need. And primary care is so important. As far as GPs, I think that what GPs are going to do in the future needs it will be different to now, in that GPs need to spend longer with patients. Well, you know, in my lifetime, I've been part of the campaigns to increase it from 4.5 minutes up to now 10 is most appointment slots. Average is 12.5, I think. I have a flexible appointment scheme where in our surgery, we don't have to spend the same amount of time with each patient. I spend twice as long. I like talking and listening. And some patients, you know, I'll spend half an hour, three quarters of an hour with. I think you can get much more sorted out like that way. But I think patients also then have to accept that a lot of the long-term condition care for asthma, for diabetes, will increasingly be managed with the GP by nurses and others. The evidence is that nurses do better than GPs and pharmacists in some areas, the Isle of Wight, do better on long-term condition, where they're managing it as a rules-based system. So I think what we've got to do as patients and doctors actually work together to change the NHS from the bottom up, and primary care is where it needs to start. But there is no excuse for what we have in some areas of this country still, patients being turned away by GPs for whatever reasons. GPs need to be able to, patients need to be able to access GPs of high quality.
Can we move on to, I know there's a lot of people trying to get in, but can we move on to competition?
Because oh, an easy one.
We think you're ready for this one. So thoughts on competition. Sir, yeah.
Hello, Steve. I'm Charles West. And you're a GP.
You look different, actually.
you and I share an interest in and a concern about teaching and training. Mm. But competition is, I think, perhaps the key one. And we had a lot of discussion about this before you came.
Yeah.
Because it seems to me that collaboration is one of the hallmarks of the best quality healthcare systems. Mm-hmm. It's collaboration whereby you learn the latest technique or the best technique, share best practice. It's collaboration that means that clinicians don't overreach themselves and take on things they're not capable of doing. They're happy to refer to somebody else or collaborate with them. Mm. You talked just now about collaboration at primary care level, of course.
Yeah.
Both have been doing that for years. But more and more collaboration is becoming important. Cancer can't be delivered properly without multidisciplinary teams, without cancer networks.
Yeah.
As consults become more specialised, collaboration becomes even more important. Mm. And as so many of our patients are elderly and have multiple conditions, of course, they may need the services of a lot of different services. So that even something as simple as a diabetic going for hip surgery might need the help of a surgeon, an anaesthetist, a cardiologist, a diabetologist, a hematologist, and so on. Mm. You talked in your interview about good and bad competition. Now, you put your finger on the problem that it is almost impossible to separate these, because competition is the antithesis of collaboration. If you and I are in competition, it's in my interest to put you out of business, because that'll help my trade. Competition will actually break down the collaboration that has been so important in the NHS. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I agree with almost every single point that you've made there. There is a little bit about competition, though. So where competition helps, and there is some evidence on competition on quality, you can actually improve access and drive up standards in some managed cases. And in business terms, it's about expanding the market. So it's about making things available to more people rather than competing within a narrow market, which is where opticians and pharmacists and others would play a particular role. But as you know, I believe very strongly in collaboration between doctors, between nurses. We haven't had as good collaboration in primary care between doctors and pharmacists as we should have had in the past. Often that's competition and doesn't help. And I think we do need collaboration and integration. But patients tell us that they want some choice where they have their knee or their hip operation or their hernia. And in my very, very deprived part of central Birmingham, we can send our minor surgical operations like that to I think it was the old Nuffield Hospital, which is a private hospital in Birmingham, instead of the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital. And some of our patients, because it's only half a mile from where they live, choose to go there. Now, the question is, how do you help patients who tell us they want that choice whilst not destabilising the main part of the infrastructure of the NHS that we all need? And the example I gave in The Guardian was a trauma centre, but it might be in a very rural area something else. The current tariff, if you understand the tariff, the amount of money people pay for things, is a problem in that if you have your hip operation in the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital, you're subsidising the training of doctors for those who might work in the private sector. So my belief, and to test it out, is that the private hospitals should probably pay for the training through some form of levy. So that's one suggestion I've got, which the Prime Minister raised this morning, so, you know, he's listening to us. So there is an issue about that. Also, if you're in rural Herefordshire, I use Hereford because I just know it well, on the edge of England, costs of running those services will be more because the throughput is less than if you're in a city. But patients still might want to have the choice of going and having their operation done in Birmingham because their mother lives there, or their sister or something. So we've had choice since 1948. People have had a choice of moving around. It's not a new thing. 20% of mental health care is provided by non-historic NHS providers. But the issue the psychologist raised earlier on is, how do you manage to do that without reducing quality and making sure that the NHS doesn't fall apart about us, which was my point in The Guardian. It's blindingly obvious, but I thought somebody ought to state it, really. That was why I was coming at it.
Gentleman there's been trying to come in.
My name's Simon Layden. I come from Cumbria. I was, until recently, an active politician in health scrutiny. And I want to go back to the GP commissioning thing for a moment. It links up to the rest of it. The proposal which came out of Cumbria was not, as Andrew Lansley reported widely, that GPs should simply be the commissioners. It was that GPs should have a leading role in commissions, in commissioning. I was very glad to hear the comment that you yourself made earlier. The question as to what happened in Cumbria, the round figure is 80% of the commissioning money goes to the GPs and 20% goes to the others. Now, what's that 20% used for? And will the GPs be the best people to have a part in advising how it should be used? It's public health, it's any health services in the community, it's virtually anything which, although the NHS may feel pressed for finance, all these other services are more pressed.
Yeah. Were you happy with Cumbria and how the commissioning moved forward?
Personally, I think it is a very considerable move forward. It may be partly because we do appear to have an unusually high integrity, high competent group of GPs.
Yeah.
But a lot of us are very much happier with what we've got than with what we had. Not least because of the cliquish battles between hospital consultants on the one side, etc.
Well,
but the key thing that we need to keep the peace in Cumbria, at the level of reducing the number of marches so that people can get on with the job, what we actually need is effective local scrutiny so people can show when the leakages are not working.
That
is even more important in Cumbria than the choice. The choice, they can be advised by the GPs, and hope that will make it.
I've got it. I agree.
I hope we'll make it very, very strong.
I just want to get lots of questions in. So, I agree. Scrutiny, absolutely right. I would call that governance, scrutiny the same. The reason Cumbria has been relatively successful so far, and it's relative because they haven't gone as far as they might do yet, for all sorts of reasons, is that they've actually had very good public and specialist leadership in there, as well as GPs. And I know nurses have been engaged as well. And so what's happened in Cumbria is it is clinical leadership, and they've had very good management support. Because I know one of my team leads one of your areas, and or one of my old team, Mike Buick. I don't know if you know him. And yeah, and but they've had good scrutiny, as you know, on you know, they've been managed in that system. Now, the plans in the bill are for the commissioning board to do that scrutiny and management. And the problem in Cumbria is actually your hospital set up, your acute hospitals, isn't
absolutely.
It? And that's the issue there.
Absolutely, but the GP cannot satisfy the public as commissioner
yeah.
unless the hospital service is
yeah.
viable.
Thank you.
The
thank
hospital
you.
Service with the relevant choice goes down.
Yeah, I understand.
Let's try and get some more voices in. Colleague in the middle, at the back there, yes.
I'm a Hackney GP. I've got to leave in a minute to pick my kids up, but I believe passionately in the NHS and I really want to express an opinion before I have to leave. Mm. I think we're missing the wood for the trees. This is about the introduction of the free market into healthcare in this country. All the evidence shows that this would introduce a system that is more expensive than the one we have, inequitable, with worse health outcomes. It will destroy collaboration between different practitioners. It will end up with cherry picking by these big multinational companies of the most profitable hospital services and of the most profitable GP patients, landing the Cinderella services on a rump NHS, which will not be able to cope. Hospitals will close, patients will suffer. Reform requires collaboration, not competition. The bill is not amendable. Many, many people believe, doctors and patients, it needs to be thrown out and to start again.
We'll take that as a statement, but just as a point of information, presumably you've not got involved in a consortium yourself.
Not personally, although I have a very local consortium.
But my question was, has your practice...
Yes.
Why?
We have to. We have no choice. We're being herded into them. We have no choice. We voted, a huge majority voted at my ELIC East London consortium meeting last October. The vast majority of 90 GPs were there voted against this bill. But we also all expressed very clearly the opinion that we had no choice but to prepare for the changes that are being forced on us.
Okay.
And the government is telling the public lies that we want these changes.
Just because people get into the lifeboat doesn't mean they're in favour of sinking the Titanic.
It's a brilliant quote, wasn't it? I do hear what you're saying. I have... been around, is it 3,000-4,000 people we've met in the last 4 weeks or so? I hear what you're saying. We've spoken and fed back that we do hear that from some people. We also I don't work for the government. I'm just telling you what we've heard. So,
let Steve answer.
You know, so we hear that as a particular view. We also hear people say there is evidence X, Y, and Z.
Do you think? Do you think the bill is unamendable?
I think the bill needs changing in order to reflect what people's concerns are and make sure we don't cherry pick and whatever. In the end, it's not for me to amend the bill. That's my job. What I've got to do is write a report, which you saw a flavour of in The Guardian on Saturday, which would say, of course you shouldn't allow what you're describing as cherry picking. Of course you should have a more collaborative, integrated healthcare system. What I would disagree with you on is, I think personally what I've been hearing is the concept of clinicians designing and getting more involved in what we now call in England commissioning, it's only an English word, about design of the healthcare system with patient and public input is essential. So I don't hear any problem with that.
The bill doesn't do that. The bill doesn't do that.
The,
I don't disagree with that sentiment. It's just the bill doesn't achieve that end.
Well,
I'd like to point out, we're all here today. I'm just quoting The Guardian. David Cameron used to insist today that there will be few compromises on the controversial NHL bill. So why are we all here today?
Just to point out a technicality.
I'm very glad you've come. Thank you.
The technicality is The Guardian was printed before anybody'd seen his speech. So to say that that is what was actually going to happen,
let's just pick up some more views, some more online views, very quickly, Laura. Microphone, please, at the front. Start, make a start.
I'll shout anyway.
Right.
So,
go on.
No. Thank you. Okay, so this is from Rita Rennie. Doesn't disclose whether they work for the NHS or are patient services or whatever, but picks up on the point about the process and pace of these changes and just asks, if the listening exercise was intended to take the view of the country into account, then why did so many of the reforms continue to be carried out while the listening exercise? And also, this is a sort of more specific point that I thought was quite interesting to raise because it's actually been left by a spokesperson for Lloyds Pharmacy, who says they welcome the broad thrust of the Health and Social Care Bill, are concerned that the focus is too narrow. So this is what they'd like to see kind of redrafted. To achieve the ambitions of the health bill embodies, local consortia must be extended to include all frontline clinicians. Community pharmacists bring a unique perspective and can provide an overarching view of medicine use across the patient pathway. The NHS medicines bill is around £10 billion each year. The insights pharmacy can provide about efficient medicines management and reducing wastage are invaluable. Against this backdrop, what is your view on the role of community pharmacy in the new NHS structure, and how can we ensure that local commissioning leads to proper integration of care?
Steve, you talked in the interview on Saturday about getting a broader clinical voice into the consortia.
Yeah. I mean, two things. I mean, pharmacists specifically, I asked for a pharmacist to be on our group, and Ash Sonny, who is actually a PET chair from one of the London areas, is doing that. I tried when I led the College of GPs to get a joint paper between the Royal College of GPs and the Royal Pharmaceutical Society looking at how GPs and pharmacies should work together. I didn't manage to get it signed off by our own council before the end. One of the things I would love to see achieved, it won't be me because I'm listening rather than doing, is getting pharmacists and GPs to actually work together for the interests of their local patients much more effectively. Where it works, it's great, but there are still a lot of tensions there. So the answer to the how you get clinicians involved in commissioning, well, if you had every medical specialty on the consortia board, there would be 65 registered medical specialties and general practice, 14 allied health professional groups, pharmacists, dentists and others. So you can't do that. But what we're proposing is we've listened to a lot of what people want. And I think what we can do is we can make sure that in either the legislation or the secondary legislation, there is a commitment to involve nurses and specialists and others in design of every pathway. You can make that. But then we think something like a clinical cabinet of clinicians from a particular geographical area, so that if you had, say, three consortia, they would link into them, social care could link into them. And that would also then, after that, spurn interest into the networks for specific things like maternity care and things. And the clinical cabinet idea would mean that you could get your orthotist or your diabetes specialist nurse engaged. You know, you could get your dentist or your pharmacist. So, and that's that. Feeding that back is not in the bill because you don't put things like that in a bill. What will have to happen is either secondary legislation or probably the assurance processes. You can't put everything in a bill. It's too big as it is. It needs shrinking down, probably.
We've gone past 3 o'clock, but we are continuing, as promised. Sandwiches have arrived outside. If anybody's fainting with hunger, just leave quietly and grab a bag.
Grab a bag.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. Trying to do all of that. And I'm coming to the gentleman in the middle next. And then I will. If you've got a question, sir, I'll come to you directly.
Thank you very much. My name is Stuart Maxwell. I'm governor of the Foundation Trust in East London. Mm-hmm. You were just talking about governance, and I'd be particularly interested in your views about if these consortia go ahead, the role of the public. Because it's all very well to talk about whether or not there should be different clinicians involved. But I do think there should be some democratic accountability and not just local authority councillors.
I could say I'm more interested in your views than my views, because I honestly haven't got a fixed view on patient public engagement. So you tell me what you think should happen, and then we'll take a few views. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Personally, and obviously because I am a Foundation Trust governor,
yeah.
I feel that we fulfil a useful role. I feel that the community involvement matches something that used to be fulfilled by the community health councils, which was fairly scrapped. But what I'd be particularly interested in is the fact that the PCTs weren't perfect, but they were independent. I think the fact that the clinicians have a duty...
Sorry, somebody's... No, I think it's your lunch.
Put it down
there. That's fine. On the side.
Put it down there.
You carry on. Well, the only thing I'm not sure about is how independent PCTs were, because I thought they were micromanaged from the top, actually, but anyway.
No, I mean, I'm not saying they were perfect.
Yeah. So, what I'm saying, should we take the governors as a...
independent,
yeah.
And they were accountable in as much as, to some extent, they were accountable to the local authority. So all I'm saying is, I don't like the look of the consortia, the way that they are currently described.
Please give me some solutions, because that's what I really want to hear.
I would like to see the chair and some of the governors, if they're called governors, as I am, being elected from the local community.
Okay.
If it's good enough for the police service, which I think is a mad idea. if it's good enough for the Tory party as far as that's concerned,
yeah.
Then why isn't it good enough for the
Let's do an answer.
I'm not political at all. So if some people could just give me very snappily what they want on the patient involvement, we could take lots of other comments then. Just quickly would be really helpful.
Yeah. So come on, I said you could come in. Is this on patient involvement? Is this on this issue of patient involvement?
This is a wider question than that.
I'll come back to you, honestly. Patient involvement only.
Just tell me what we need to do.
Yeah?
Yes. My name is Bonnie Green. I'm chair of Richmond Link.
Right.
And hopefully we will involve into Local Health Watch. Certainly, as adult profession, we would want to have Local Health Watch representation on the commissioning governing board. I was a member of the PCT board as an observer, so they were accountable through that route, so I would like to see consortia accountable through that route, but I don't think that Local Health Watch should be used as a proxy for patient and public involvement. There should be wider patient and public involvement on GP commission boards to represent patients, users, and particularly carers, because we can't
I'm glad you brought up carers. They very rarely come up in conversation in meetings like this, and they're essential to whatever we do.
Okay, let's take some quick fire suggestions as Steve has requested.
My name's Roger Tell. I'm from a patient participation group, law school practice in Hackney. Throughout this discussion and in your article and other things, patients don't seem to be being talked about or put in place as much as I would hope or expect. For example, consortiums don't seem to have a patient representative in them. You're not even suggesting that all GP practices should have a patient participation group.
You tell me give me the solution, because I understand what the problem is.
Well,
I really do understand what the problem is.
Those are my solutions. Firstly, that there should be patient participation groups associated with all practices.
Yep.
If you're a small practice, you may join them together, but for being certain,
I agree.
It should be that.
I agree, yeah.
And I think into the consortium and into the other levels of this fairly complicated structure, you need patients to be represented throughout. You proposed adding nurses and I can't remember what else, but you didn't propose adding patients.
Genuinely, because I want to know from you what your suggestions are, because there's a diverse sort of feeling for how you do that?
I think I'm made.
That's fine.
Okay. Yes, gentleman on the end of the row there.
Hi, Andy Klein from Dr. Foster. What patients need is information to make choice, and what you need to do is get the information freed up. I mean, you just said it was difficult to get GPs working with pharmacists. Well, why don't we take the information out of their control and just free it up and give it to everybody? Now, I know the information revolution has been promised by the government, but I mean, we've heard that that might start with 4 or 5, maybe 6 different data sets, and that'll happen in time. That's not good enough. It needs to be for this to work. I mean, we're world leaders in acute hospital information. Let's do it across the care pathway.
You've got primary care as well. I agree with you on. I mean, I assume as a group, we're all patients or potential patients. You would all want as much information as you could get. I mean, I think sometimes the messages are quite patronising about, oh, well, the patients don't understand that. And I find that really offensive. It's usually about professional self-interest, isn't it?
Can I say something? I used to chair the PhD in inner London.
Yeah.
I chaired the Greater London CAC and also on the National.
Yeah.
They were at least independent. They had a right to be consulted about change of health services and provision.
Yeah.
There was a dialogue, a real dialogue. It wasn't perfect by any means. But also, they had some consumer base to do their own independent research.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not providers. They were consumers. Now, there doesn't seem to be a strong consumer-patient involvement voice. And leaving aside the pressure groups that pressure for one particular healthcare issue.
Yeah. Will Health Watch not do that?
You're asking for solutions.
Yeah.
Well, at the moment, I don't see anything in what you said today or anybody else that actually would enhance the independence and the role of the consumers. And to keep saying as this mantra that there'll be patient involvement, that is just a cliche word.
But tell me what the solution is.
Give any specifics.
But really, what's the solution from you?
Our own research base and independent of the providers. We had it once, and it could be improved.
So the CHC model. That's what you want.
Okay, Steve obviously wants hard, practical suggestions. Who's got them? Come on. Lady here? No, we'll come to you in the middle.
Thank you. It's Elizabeth Duff from charity NCT. I do agree with what others have said about CHC because I used to chair one and I think they were excellent. But specifically in the area of maternity services, you're probably familiar with the model of maternity service liaison committees, which have in many parts of the country an excellent track record, not just of providing the consumer voice, being well-functioning groups, usually, nearly always with a lay chair, but providing a fantastic forum for real multidisciplinary debate and an equitable place where, for example, nurses, GPs, midwives, managers, obstetricians and paediatricians get together. So I'm proposing that as a sort of model that works not only in maternity but elsewhere.
I mean, notes are being taken of this. So that's
other models? Yes.
While we're handing the microphone, the reason I'm... apologies to your colleague, because I'm meant to be at the maternity meeting at the moment. So,
briefly, if you can, yes.
Yeah, well, I can, but if you want a viable alternative, which I'm proposing, it just needs a wee little bit of time, okay? And I'm having to leave out the travesties, which are the background of all this stuff. Some people need reminding about that. Okay, first of all, there needs to be a moratorium on the abolition of the primary care trust for 3 years. Let's have a review at the end of that time, by all means, if you want it. Why do we want the PCTs? Do I want the PCTs to stay? Because that's where the commissioning expertise is, and the previous administration spent millions training these people to do world-class commissioning. The point about it is that we need to change what the PCT boards, are like. Radically, and that can be done much more cheaply than anything that the white paper or the bill is proposing, and much quicker. What do? You have a directly publicly elected primary care trust.
and 50% of its membership is directly publicly elected, not via councils or councillors, directly. You have proper representation for GPs, proper representation for hospital doctors, and proper representation for other healthcare professionals, and that body then elects a lay chair. Now, this will address, first of all, the huge expense involved in the reorganisation, which the government is lying about. Secondly, it will address the... it will be done much more quickly. Thirdly, it will stop the morale destabilisation by the whole reorganisation, which we are promised wouldn't happen. And fourthly, it will, for the first time in the National Health Service, address the democratic governance of the National Health Service, all in one go. And if you do that, and the reason is because... To keep the commissioning where it is, because that needs to go ahead, not at the same time as a huge reorganisation and £20 billion worth of cuts.
Thank you.
That is criminal insanity.
Thank you. A real tour, I think Steve got the message, a real tour de force. Let's come to this row here.
I'm glad I'm not a politician.
Oh, he's good. He's absorbing it, and he'll comment in a moment.
It's an alternative.
Joseph Cochran, the former NHS commissioner and now an independent contractor. I wanted the idea that the GP commissioning board needs to be able to have a whole series of stakeholder groups looking after the different care pathways. I think it's important that there is a clear accountability with the Health Watch, that they actually are engaging with the clinicians, the carers, the patients, in order to make their decision. What I am very concerned about is the addition of people who do not hold the budget, so the GPs will have been given a budget into the consortia, making decisions, and therefore providing GPs the opportunity, sorry, we can make a decision because of these other people, and I believe that we need to keep a very clear link between the budget holding and the decision, but the accountability also has to be present.
Okay, can we come to the front?
Richard Chan from Swell.
From?
I don't represent any groups.
Right.
But basically what we're talking about is finances, save money, privatisation. When start from the top, work down, cut the administration staff by 50%, work with every hospital, back to grassroots, and take the money. That's where the money is saved.
Right.
But not through privatisation, through
backdoor, as possible. Okay, let's try and stay on patient involvement if we can, for the moment. Valid point, but can we work our way along the row? I'll come to you in a minute.
Sorry, it's Pauline Green again. I just wanted to stand up for Links and Local Health Watch, because my link particularly is representative of its community, and membership is gathered from the community. We work closely with the voluntary sector, so we are that patient voice representing
some are very good
carers.
Some less so.
A successful local health watch.
Yeah.
It's not, the funding is not guaranteed.
Thank you. You've had your say, madam.
It's not guaranteed funding.
Yes.
Hello, Robert McGibbon. I'm a retired Camden GP, member of the college for longer than you were a student, latterly a fellow. I was going to say something else, I might have a chance later, but in the answer to your question, the very simple answer is, in the interest of democracy and accountability, the Secretary of State must have a legal duty to provide NHS comprehensive experience.
Yes, Wendy, and then behind.
Wendy Simmons, Chief NHS Public, retired obstetrician and gynaecologist. Have you read the bill?
I've read the bill three times personally, actually four times now this weekend. I've had it read to me. I've had legal advice on aspects of it. And I've also had debates about it. So the answer to your question is a resounding yes.
Right. Well, in the part where it's talking about GPs and patient involvement, it says that the GPs may consult, they may inform, they may invite people onto committees. But just telling people what's going to happen isn't good enough. And that part of the bill needs to be radically changed to really get the patient representation that we've heard about before. And I completely agree with what Robert says about the duties of the Secretary of State for Health. And a saying that he should act with a view to promote is not the same thing as being responsible for providing the services.
The gentleman behind you, Wendy, yes, sir.
My name is Barry Feinberg. I come from background architecture, urban design and planning, in that order. I've also had 10 years of punishment on voluntary public project monitoring, tracking the chaos of the past 10 years and the preceding 10 or 20 years. And here today, your arrival so late, none of your fault, is symptomatic of the enormous congestion, not only that there is in London, but in all our institutions. And that unmanageable complexity is at the root of the irreconcilable demand, of the number of unmanageable variations in the whole scene. And as an architect and designer, I feel the only remedy, and here's the, giving you the diagnosis, which are all the complexity, on a massive scale, is to break it down in a manageable way, so that each part is totally manageable and accountable and reflects local communities. So my recommendations are that we need to do some social mapping to identify local communities around local town centres, to make them largely autonomous to some extent in controlling and providing services which are based on a much more accurate, focused and sensitive reflection of local. And that the democratic process that is needed and framework to make that happen, in fact, meet the democratic deficit.
I guess the issue...
And you have, in fact, hinted at some of your change recommendations...
You take this job,
hierarchy, systemic approach within which the department has
I think as an architect, you'd recognise form and function. Yes. I mean, the most important thing here is defining what the function is, so that we can work out what form it is to deliver it. And that's the critical thing. They're correct.
Any last fresh points on patient involvement that haven't been made? Yes? Yes.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline Stevenson, representing the African Health Policy Network. And I have two distinct but related recommendations on patient involvement. Firstly, that patient involvement should not only be mandatory, but should be mandatory in terms of proper representation, which means not just going to the usual suspects, not just seeking out the generic organisations, but recognising the specialist reach of the specialised organisations, in my case, obviously, the African organisations. Linked to that, my second recommendation is recognising the skills and reach of the national organisations representing those marginalised groups. The African community is only around 1% of the UK population. It's very difficult in a localised agenda for that community to truly be heard and to reach that critical mass where their voices become the loudest. On the national level, however, an organisation like mine can provide that.
OK. Steve, would you like to just wind up on just reflect on some of those points?
I mean, lots of very good ideas. And the issue for me is how you take all of those ideas and the ideas of lots of others who are inputting in different ways and synthesise that to trigger a government response. It's not my job to write the detail, as Wendy would say, of the bill. It's actually to trigger a response which gives the desired outcome.
I promise to bring in this gentleman here.
My name is Isabellan. I'm a governor of the Specialist Hospital Trust. I'm also occasionally reading the Daily Telegraph as well. My question is
Thunderbolt.
This is not only just a Guardian left wingers. Anyway, the health and social care bill is expected to come into force in 2030, if not 14. But the bill would not be effective before the next general election in 2015. This would result, the new administration would disregard the above bill and would reform again. Please comment on this wasteful resources and also potential uncertainties. I would like to suggest is this cyclic nature of reform and reform by incoming administrations cost enormous amount of money, valuable resources. Can we use these valuable resources to make use the people at the lower strata help in the name of business culture, bonus culture, you know, in the health services as a whole, at the top of the hierarchy, business culture exists. Bonus culture exists. So this culture can be extended for the lower strata of the people using the wasteful resources.
Okay, thank you. Laura, what's interesting people online?
Oh, very many things, but I only have a chance to read a few, and I just want to pick up on a couple of points.
I think I'll limit you to two.
About patient involvement. One was a suggestion from Andrew Craig, who's part of the MAC partnership, or MAC partnership, about HealthWatch, and just saying that if Seafield or anyone else thinks that patient and public involvement can or even should all be done by HealthWatch and its local offshoots, it shows they have no real understanding or practical experience of what involvement, engagement and consultation with service users and the public is about. So then they go on to talk about how local health work is more than links rebranded, and that as a statutory body, LHW will probably have a seat on top-level governance group, whether or not it's called a board of the GP commissioning consortium, and be able to make reports to the wider community following each meeting. There must be integration between viable local health watch and many other types of involvement and engagement at the grassroots, clinical commissioning structures and local providers. The most important part of this is patient participation in each practice and foundation trust members who really have a voice through their governance.
Okay.
That's good. And I would be doing our readers a disservice if I didn't ask this, as it's come up over and over again from one reader who asks in particular, could Professor Field explain exactly what Mark Britnell meant when he said that NHS reforms offer a big opportunity for the for-profit sector? He's also asking David Cameron, so if you can get an answer from the PM, that would be much appreciated. Explain why these proposed reforms are not a top-down reorganisation of the NHS. If they are such a thing, can he explain why he's reversed his pledge, this is Cameron, not to embark on a top-down reorganisation?
I'm not a member of the Conservative Party. I don't work for them. I know Mark Britnell because he used to run University Hospital Birmingham. But I've read what you've read, and he's wrong, isn't he, in this? I don't believe there's any intention, actually.
I suppose it's left us with a profound worry about whether your future forum is going to have a significant voice, or whether...
Right. Okay. Well, I'm not aware of any kitchen cabinet or meetings of a group which is ongoing there at all. Mark Britnell, I know, but he's, from what I've only read what you've read.
But
hang on, let Steve finish the point.
No, I mean, I've only read what you've read. I wasn't in New York when he said it, so. But he has a legitimate view as a citizen of England, as you have a legitimate view as well. We might disagree or agree. My job is to hear views which have gone from let's have a free market because that's the only way we'll sort out quality through to let's have a system where, it's so tied down locally that there is no choice for the patients. And most of us are between the two.
But you...
I'm just saying.
You did.
I've heard lots and lots of different views.
Let's just.
I've got another 2 weeks to carry on listening to different views.
Let's just clarify your
why
comment.
I came here. It would have been easier not to, frankly. I wanted to come and listen to you. That's why I struggled across town.
Hang on. Steve, let's just clarify what you said. And so, in case it's misreported, you said. As reported, Mark Britnell was wrong.
If he is saying that this is going to be a system which is, I think it was national insurance-led, I think. I can't remember the words.
Just let Steve finish.
And if it was what you're describing, then I have not heard any intention from anyone in government that is what they want to do. I've not heard that.
Okay.
This morning, I spent some time talking to Prime Minister on our own as well as in the large group. what came across, I don't know if you showed the interview here.
No, we didn't.
But what came across from David Cameron, what comes across in private as well as in public, is his real care and love for the NHS.
What Democratic
We've been asked to... No,
I think you're asking questions
I'm not a politician.
Steve's
I'm
brief.
Just saying, I
I have to say, Steve Field has been invited here. However, passions become inflamed. We must have a courteous debate. I mean, so please.
Yeah, thank you. No, I think he's answered. I think he's answered very candidly and to the best of his knowledge on the question of Mark Britnell. So let's try and move on. A couple of people we haven't heard from in this second row.
I'm not speaking on behalf of anybody, obviously I'm a patient and taxpayer, which is my second point.
Yep.
Just following on very quickly, it's interesting that David Cameron confirmed that there would be, quote, substantive changes to the legislation, but he said that it was not right, or the right time rather, to say what these were until the rest of the plea. And obviously you've said that this would be in a couple of weeks, so it's quite interesting what he's thinking.
Yeah.
Potentially before your report is complete.
Yeah.
My question was actually, we've talked a lot about GP commissioning, competition, things like that, and a lot of the focus has really been around the services, which you know are the bulk of the cost of the NHS, really. In the speech today, Cameron also commented on the increase in the uptake of drugs used. For example, we talked about Herceptin,
he did.
Product from Roche that wasn't available before with the biomarkers it is, and so on. So I'd like to kind of hear your views on how the NHS reforms will impact accessibility to drugs.
Okay. We're running out of time now, so we'll leave it there.
I mean, you know, I've come to listen. I mean, the detail on the Mark Britnell bit is I haven't read... I've only heard on the radio. I haven't seen what he actually said. Therefore, it's very difficult to comment, apart from I have heard no intention amongst any politician from any party that I've met with. And I've got another meeting in the House of Commons tomorrow because I said I'd listen to their concerns as well. I've not heard any intention to go down the route that was described on the radio. So that's where I think... If that's been picked up from government, I do believe that is wrong because I haven't heard that. But I can only say, as you can, that's an I statement. I believe the NHS is something so sacred for us that we have to help it grow and develop. And the NHS in 5 years will have many more drugs like Herceptin. You know, my wife at the moment is going through some horrendous breast cancer treatment. Having had this on and off for 13 years, and we're going through a bad phase at the moment. The care she's getting in University Hospital Birmingham is unbelievably good. The drugs she's getting are unbelievably expensive. But actually, you know, her quality of life is good. She deserves those free as an NHS and a taxpayer like you are. And I believe when we start to look at ovarian cancer and the other serious cancers, the genetic developments... will actually produce very expensive and very good drugs. If that's going to happen, what are we going to not do that we're doing now in order, or are we going to do it more productively in the future? Because the lesson from around the world is there is not enough money in health systems to pay for everything everybody feels they want. It's a question of how we do it to what we need. That which might mean that we're doing things in a different way, which... So technology can actually make the health service cheaper. So if you look in other industries how technology has reduced costs, we need to take those sort of things on board. So that's why the health service has to change. I do not believe that the politicians want to dismember the NHS in any way. And my job is to listen to all these various views and in 2 weeks' time write a paper which helps them in some way take this forward. Some of the things that I'm reviewing, just as a final point, are actually not in the bill at all. So Wendy quite rightly says something needs to be in the bill, particularly to do this. My job is not to assess actually whether that is technically what needs to happen. a lot of the education and changing and workforce changes are not in the bill at all, but how do you make those happen? What is frankly obvious are that many of the changes are being proposed too rapidly and would destabilise the NHS. So we will say some strong things about the pace of change in some areas, but it's not my role to decide how that then happens. So I'd just like to thank you for your questions and for your very assertive comments. I like and I believe and I feel as passionately, genuinely about the NHS as you do. But, no, I said we've got until for it. I've got to go and meet the Royal College of Nursing and a group of nurses. So the last meeting we cancelled, we do need to travel across town, and it looks as though it's going to be tricky. So thank you. Carry on blogging in the Guardian blog, because the team reads that every day.
Just before you go, please thank Steve very much.